Last week, we considered Job and the terrible, horrible, very bad, no good, very bad day, in which our hero loses all of his wealth, all 10 of his children in quick succession. Now, I imagine some point during that day, the thought may have crossed Job's mind, well, at least it can't get any worse than this. Not so fast, Job. You have come to a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day, the sequel. And like most sequels, it's worse. Job chapter 2 begins with Satan's personal attack on Job, described in the first 8 verses. On another day, the angels came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came with them to present himself before him. And the Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Satan answered the Lord, "From roaming through the earth and going back and forth in it." Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There's no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil. And he still maintains his integrity, though you incited me against him to ruin him without any reason." "Skin for skin," Satan replied. "A man will give all he has for his own life. But if you stretch out your hand and strike his flesh and bones, he will surely curse you to your face." The Lord said to Satan, "Very well then, he is in your hands, but you must spare his life." So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and afflicted Job with painful sores from the soles of his feet to the top of his head. Then Job took a piece of broken pottery and scraped himself with it as he sat among the ashes. Now, those first few verses sound an awful lot like chapter 1, don't they? Up in heaven, the angels are presenting themselves before the Lord, and here is Satan presenting himself as well. Gives you the idea that even Satan has to answer to God. And God says to Satan, "Where have you been?" Satan says, "Hanging around, going back and forth in the earth." And once again, God says, "Have you considered my servant Job?" Word for word, describes him just like he did in chapter 1. Blameless, upright, fears God, shuns evil. There's nobody like him in the whole world. And then he adds, "And he's maintained his integrity, even though you incited me to ruin him without any reason." In other words, Job passed the test. It's God's way of saying, "Ha ha, you said Job would curse me, and he didn't. So there." Well, Satan's not that impressed. Skin for skin. Not exactly sure what that means, but the next phrase spells it out. A man will give all that he has for his own life. Yeah, you took away his wealth. You took away his children, but you know, he can still have more kids. He can build another business empire. He really hasn't lost anything, but if you strike his flesh and bones, if you make it personal, who knows? He might have been willing to give up all of his wealth and even his children to save his own skin. He's implying that Job is really selfish, even in maintaining his integrity before God. "Every man has his price," Satan says of Job. "And I'll bet that if you strike him personally, he will curse you to your face." Now, God rejects Job's reasoning, but he allows Satan to test Job again. But notice, he again sets a boundary. "Satan, you can only go so far. You can afflict him. You can make him suffer, but you cannot kill him." Because trust me, Satan would have loved nothing better than to wipe Job off the face of the earth. And if you're a believer in Jesus Christ, he'd like to do the same thing to you. You say, "What'd I do to him?" You're a threat. You're a threat to all of his plans. Besides that, you make God look good, and he hates that. He'll do anything he can to make God look bad, and especially through his children. But God always sets the limits to what Satan can do. And that's good news. That's something we need to remember when we see Satan at work. He is still on a leash. He can only go as far as God allows. Now, before we look into Job's physical suffering, I want to point something out. It's very clear in Job's case that Satan is the instigator. If we ask the question, why did Job suffer the way he did? The answer is Satan. The text tells us Satan afflicted Job with these painful boils. But does that mean that every sickness, every disease, every physical ailment, does it come from the devil? Now, if you watch enough television preachers, and I hope you don't, you get these faith healers up there, and they're casting out the demon of asthma and the demon of arthritis, and, you know, like every little ailment comes from the devil. No, it doesn't. The Bible's very clear on that. Now, it's true. Sometimes it is. Satan's demons can cause, among other things, blindness, muteness, physical deformities, incessant pain, insanity. You see examples of that in the New Testament. Whatever Paul's thorn in the flesh was, and the way he words that makes me think it was some kind of physical suffering, he identifies it as the work of Satan. So yes, sometimes Satan is the cause, but not always. Sometimes our suffering comes as a result of our own choices. It's our own fault. We make foolish decisions, we pay the price. Sometimes our suffering comes from the choices of others. Because, unfortunately, consequences are not always limited to the one who chooses. There's a ripple effect. And what one person does may affect many other people in the process. So our cause might be others' choices. Some suffering can only be chalked up to original sin. We live in a cursed world in which disease and disaster and death, disability, all these things have come as a result of when Adam and Eve first sinned in the garden. And yes, at times, sometimes our suffering comes from the hand of the oppressor, Satan. But not always. And I would think we need to make that very clear. While it's true here, don't think that it's always that way. Now, whatever the cause of suffering might be, we can say categorically that God is still in control. God is in control of the consequences of choice, ours or others. God is still in control of this cursed world. Even though it is in decay, even though it is getting worse, God is still in control. And certainly God never leaves Satan to do anything he wants. He always maintains his sovereignty, even over the devil. And so we can rest assured that whatever suffering or sickness we may be enduring, or maybe someone we love, God can still work good out of it. Romans 8:28 is a very often quoted verse. And I remember growing up learning it, and all things work together for good to those who love God and are called according to His purpose. But you know, it's not all things that are good. A better way of understanding that verse is in all things, God works for the good. Because there are a lot of things in life that just aren't good. The things that happened to Job are evil. But through it, God can still work good. Why? Because He's in control. And that's a great assurance for us. Verse 7 records that Satan afflicted Job with painful sores. Some translations say boils from head to toe. We're not exactly sure medically what that means, but that phrase appears a couple other places in the Old Testament. One is one of the plagues in Egypt. God inflicted the Egyptians with these painful sores. And then King Hezekiah in 2 Kings 20 was afflicted with a painful sore or a boil. And it's the same wording. Now, medical doctors have been curious about this ailment for years. Some have diagnosed Job with smallpox, another elephantitis, another chronic eczema, another leprosy. One suggests psoriasis, another keratosis. Not surprisingly, several have suggested melanoma, an aggressive form of skin cancer that afflicted Job. Probably the one that fits most of the symptoms is one I can't pronounce. Kind of wish Marianne was here because she could say it for me. Pemphigus foliaceus, I guess. But it fits the symptoms because throughout the book of Job, we read of how he suffered. He speaks of inflamed, ulcerated sores, itching, degenerative changes to facial skin, a loss of appetite, depression, running sores, darkened eyelids, foul breath, loss of weight, continuous pain, restlessness, blackened skin, and fever. It's likely this probably afflicted him for a matter of months, because he speaks of the months of vanity in Job 7:3 and months gone by in Job 29:2. We don't know for sure. Maybe it was a combination of things. Whether it was a terminal illness, we're not sure. My guess is Job may have shared the experience of one I heard about who their first experience with seasickness. They were out on a boat on the ocean, and it got kind of rocky, and they were sick with seasickness. And they said, at first, you're afraid you're going to die. Then you're afraid you won't. Job probably felt that way initially. Oh, this is so horrible. I'm going to die. And after a while, he may have wished he had, just to end the suffering. It says that, verse 8, Job sat among the ashes. What do we mean by that? Well, it's probably the garbage dump, kind of the burn pile outside of the city. People take their trash and have it burned, kind of like the landfill we have not too far away. Sit among the ashes. That's where the homeless and the poor would scavenge for food, where the outcasts were taken. Now, some say that this is because he had leprosy, and he was quarantined from everybody. Well, if that was the case, his three friends couldn't have come by him. His wife probably wouldn't have gotten anywhere near him. So I don't think that was the case. This just showed his destitute state. And just maybe he wanted to get away from everybody. And so he sat out in the city dump, probably in self-exile. And don't forget, this is all heaped on top of the loss of his wealth, the loss of his children, and now the loss of his health. So try to imagine Job sitting there in complete confusion, total isolation, unbearable pain, sitting in filthy surroundings, removed from all the comforts of home, wondering if there's any hope of recovery. In short, Job became ground zero in human form. He had hit rock bottom. And into this horrendous scene comes some pathetic advice from Job's wife. We read in verse 9, his wife said to him, "Are you still holding on to your integrity? Curse God and die." So how do we understand that? Is this Satan's fiery dart of temptation? I don't think it's a coincidence that Satan told God, "He'll curse you to your face," and now Job's wife is suggesting, "Why don't you curse God?" Maybe Satan was working through the person closest to Job to try to divert him from the path of faith. Or maybe we're seeing here Mrs. Job's own misery. You know, it's hard to live near someone who's suffering and be utterly unable to do anything about it. It makes you feel bad in the process. And our own frustration can be turned to irritation with the one who is in pain. We blame them for causing us such discomfort. Job's wife suggests that he's already as good as dead. Why not just get it over with? Curse God, which was kind of a way of committing suicide, they thought. If you curse God, he'll strike you dead. Her conclusion was, Job, you've been true to God, but God hasn't been true to you. You can't change what's happened, but at least you can have the satisfaction of having the last word. Maybe that's what she was suggesting. Or maybe this is genuine sympathy. Maybe she has watched her husband lose everything, and now he is just in horrible suffering, and she just says, just end it. You've been through enough. This may be a sincere desire to see Job out of his misery, and the sooner the better. Instead of suffering continuously, just get it over with. And back then, they didn't, you couldn't take an overdose or, commit suicide in the way we might think of today. And so, curse God and let him do it for you. Yeah, maybe we've been too hard on Mrs. Job. Some call her the help me to the devil. Reminds me of a story I'd heard. It was this Sunday morning just before church starts, and Satan himself walks into the church. And he looks like everybody would imagine Satan to look, so they all recognize him, and everybody goes running and screaming out the door, except one little old guy in the front. And he doesn't move. And Satan goes up to him and gets in his face and says, "Do you know who I am?" The old man says, "Yes, I do." "Why aren't you afraid of me?" He said, "I've been married to your sister for 57 years. Now, that wasn't Mrs. Job. It's easy to see fault in what she tells Job, but maybe we're ascribing to her wrong motives as well. Maybe her idea was more like, "Job, let's just pull the plug. Don't go on. You can't keep living like this. Just be done." She's reached her limit. She's willing to let him go. I'm not justifying her reasoning. It just maybe we need to give her a little more understanding. Remember, she lost 10 children also. She lost all of her wealth. She lost her status as the first lady of Uz, that with all the respect that came with that. Job wasn't the only one to lose everything. She did lost a lot herself. Well, whatever prompted her to suggest such a thing, I'm sure it added to Job's suffering. I mean, he'd lost his wealth, he'd lost his business, he probably lost his friends. He lost his children. "At least I have my wife. At least I have my life partner with me. She'll support me." And here she comes and says, "Just curse God and die." Just another arrow stuck right into Job. And I'm sure Satan was never closer to a smile than at that moment, with him and all of his demons gathered around, and they're all saying, "Come on, Job, say it! Say it! Curse God! We can win this thing! Come on, say it, Job!" Everything hung on Job's response to his wife. And we see it in verse 10. Job replied, "You're talking like a foolish woman. Shall we accept good from God and not trouble?" And then it concludes, "In all this, Job did not sin in what he said." Now, before we get to what Job said about God, let's take a look at how he speaks to his wife. He treats her with sensitivity and speaks courteously to her against her bitter advice. He doesn't say, "You are a foolish woman." He doesn't say, "How stupid. How could you be so dumb?" Doesn't make it personal. Says, "You're talking like a foolish woman." He could have really cut her off at the knees, and he doesn't. He still maintains his respect and loving leadership for her. And then he says what one author calls one of the most challenging statements in all the Bible. Shall we accept good from God and not evil? That's a tough one, isn't it? That writer goes on to add, it is not right to take the good of life for granted and then complain about adversity. Many people respond to trouble as Job's wife did. They go through life standing at the complaint counter. They feel that God owes them an easy life and that he's unjust if everything isn't perfect. So when trouble comes, they respond to it by getting angry, bitter, and complaining against God. Job had accepted the good of life with a grateful spirit. Now he's going to endure the bad of life with a gracious spirit. He's going to take his losses with quietness and courage. He wasn't going to blame God. Now, he had some questions. And he wasn't always saying, praise the Lord. As we get into the rest of the book, you're going to wonder, as one writer says, he says, anybody talks about the patience of Job hasn't read the book. Yeah, Job gets a little testy at times. And he would like to sit down with God and have this out. Explain this to me. But he never charges God with wrongdoing. He never says, God, what you've done is wrong. He doesn't understand it. He doesn't like it. But he never faults God. And in that sense, he does not sin. This is a hard lesson to learn. Especially for those believers that feel that they've been promised health and wealth and have misunderstood God's wonderful plan for your life. That it involves only pleasantness and not trouble. Now, we on this side of the cross, we have a lot of examples in the Bible. Jesus himself and how he suffered. But Job didn't have any of that. If this story is as old as we think it is, Job may not have had anybody to look back on that had gone through this kind of suffering and how to do it. And yet out of that darkness, his strong belief in the sovereignty of God shines all the more brilliantly. One commentator writes, it is easier to lower your view of God than to raise your faith to such a height. That's good. When we get into those tough days and we're down in the dumps, it's easier to drag God down to where we are than to raise our faith to where he is. But that's exactly what Job does. Job raises his faith. I don't understand it. I don't get it. I don't think I deserve this, but I still believe. His faith actually got stronger. And once again, Job passes the test. He did not sin in what he said. And we might think that the book of Job ought to end right here. Or maybe jump right to chapter 42 where God commends him and gives it all back, right? No. We got about 39 chapters we've got to get through first. And a big reason for those 39 chapters appears in the next verse, in verse 11. When Job's three friends, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite, heard about all the troubles that had come upon him, they set out from their homes and met together by agreement to go and sympathize with him and comfort him. When they saw him from a distance, they could hardly recognize him. They began to weep aloud and tore their robes and sprinkled dust on their heads. Then they sat on the ground with him for 7 days and seven nights. No one said a word to him because they saw how great his suffering was. Word travels fast, especially bad news. It seems to travel faster than good news, doesn't it? And three of Job's friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, apparently prominent men in the region, they come to visit him. Eliphaz is probably the eldest of the three. He's listed first here. He speaks first in all of the successive chapters, and he is the one God addresses as a representative of the others. But I want you to notice this next verse, one of the most moving statements in all the book of Job. You know, for the most part, Job's friends get it all wrong. But in this case, they get it right. It says they set out from their homes, they met together by agreement to go, to sympathize with him, to comfort him. They cared enough to go a great distance. We're not exactly sure how far they came, but I don't think it was just down the street. And when they commiserated with him, they weren't sitting in a comfortable home or even a hospital room. They went to where he was in the ash heap, and they sat on the ground with him. Because their grief was so great, they didn't speak for 7 days. Now, they made up for it later, but at least at the beginning, they're doing the right thing. Now, according to the Jewish Talmud, written much later, comforters were required to remain silent until the mourner addressed them. So when you went to comfort somebody, you waited until they spoke before you would speak. Maybe that was the custom then, or it could be that they just didn't know what to say. But they stayed with him for 7 days and nights. I don't know about you, but visiting someone when they're suffering isn't the easiest thing to do, is it? Someone's in a hospital bed, or maybe in a nursing home, or maybe they're in their own home, but you know they're suffering. That's a hard thing to do. You know it's the right thing to do, and so you go and do it. But I don't know, maybe it's just me. It's hard to stay, isn't it? I mean, what do you say? And to sit there for hours, days, and not a word passes. They're waiting for Job to say something, and he's not saying anything. And they could have said, "All right, Job, good to see you." They didn't. They stayed. They stayed with him. Sometimes the best way to help people who are hurting is just to be with them. Say little or nothing. Just let them know that you're there and that you care. You don't have to explain things. Explanations never heal a broken heart. If his friends had listened to him, accepted his feelings, and not argued with him, they probably would have helped him greatly. But they chose to be prosecutors instead of comforters. In the end, the Lord rebuked them. They had to ask Job's forgiveness. I think we can learn about this in our own age. Joseph Bailey was a Christian author. He and his wife lost 3 boys, all before the age of 18, all at different ages and for different reasons. He writes, "What do we say when we talk to a grieving person? We are most likely to be helpful with an economy of words. In our contacts with people at death, as at other times, it's easy to say too much, to talk when we ought to listen. Sensitivity in the presence of grief should usually make us more silent, more listening. I'm sorry is honest. I know how you feel probably isn't. Even if you've been through exactly the same situation, they're going to react differently than you. They may not feel the same way you felt. Don't try to prove anything to a survivor. An arm around the shoulder, a firm grip of the hand, these are the proofs grief needs, not logical reasoning." Then he shares his own experience. "I was sitting torn by grief. Someone came and talked to me of God's dealings, of why it happened, of hope beyond the grave. He talked constantly. He said things I knew that were true. I was unmoved, except to wish he'd go away. And finally he did. Another came and sat beside me. He didn't talk. He didn't ask leading questions. He just sat there for maybe an hour or more, listened when I said something, answered briefly, prayed simply, and left. I was moved. I was comforted. I hated to see him go. Oftentimes, the best thing we can do is say very little, if anything at all. There was a small child that heard that an elderly lady across the street had passed away. And she told her mom, I'm going to go and comfort old Mr. Smith. Mom said, okay. So she went, and she was gone for a little while, and then she came back. And the mom said, well, what'd you tell Mr. Smith? And she said, I didn't tell him anything. I just crawled up in his lap and helped him cry. That was probably the most comfort he had received from a little child who didn't say a word, but just helped him cry. May we be those kinds of comforters for people that are in need. Job asked, shall we accept good from God and not accept adversity? He knew that God is God. Someday he would make it clear. That's one of the reasons I think heaven will be such a delightful place. When we step into his presence, and for the first time we see that panoramic view, the big picture, then probably for the first time, and not until then will we be able to say, oh, I get it. I understand. It's probably not going to happen in this life. God is totally and completely, absolutely in charge. If he wipes out every member of your family, he's in charge. If he ends your business in bankruptcy, he's in charge. If the x-ray comes back and it couldn't be worse, he is in charge. Please accept that. How magnificent it is to find those who trust him to the very end, even in suffering, saying, may his name be praised. I don't understand it. I can't explain it. But his name be praised. That's worship at its highest level. That's what faith is all about. May God enable us to raise our faith to him instead of lowering him to our pain.